The next morning, an arctic chill blew in as Eliza led her sisters up the front walk of the old Ford mansion, appropriated for General Washington's headquarters. The stately white house sat on an estate owned by a local judge who had died. While the general had use of the master's quarters, Colonel Hamilton and the other officers slept in the smaller upstairs bedrooms, sometimes two to a bed, and worked in a log office annex by day. "Would he be there this morning?" "Remain cool-headed," Eliza reminded herself. The thought of seeing Colonel Hamilton again confused and excited her. But she hadn't had time to think it all through before her aunt bundled her and her sisters out the door, their heads swimming with directions for the treatment. As the sisters stepped inside the mansion, a cloud of warm air rolled out with the heady scent of tobacco smoke. Down the hallway they overheard the boisterous voices of men unrestrained by the presence of women. Eliza walked to the doorway, which opened into what had once been the judge's study, and knocked on the door jamb. "Good morning," she said. "Dr. John Cochrane sent us." Her voice faded as she made out the room's occupants. A pair of young men hovering awkwardly over a disheveled desk. Loose papers and an inkwell had been pushed in a jumble to one side. The men sprang up guiltily, and it was only as they were straightening their vests and jackets that Eliza realized they had been arm-wrestling.
"That's funny, Larpent," the fellow beside the desk said. He was a pale blonde youth of no more than 19. "Usually it is the man who saves the damsel from distress, but in this case it is you who have been rescued by the arrival of this fair young lady."
The other fellow behind the desk was as fresh-faced as his companion, but thin and soft. A redness of his cheeks revealed that he had been on the losing side of their struggle.
"Good morning, miss," the one called Larpent ignored his friend's jibe. "How may we help you today?"
Eliza smiled officiously as she walked in the room. "My name is Eliza Schuyler, and these are my sisters, Angelica and Peggy. Dr. John Cochrane requested that we administer the smallpox inoculation to the men working in this office today, in compliance with General Washington's orders."
Larpent frowned. "The Schuyler sisters? I had been told that Mrs. Cochrane assisted Dr. Cochrane in administering the inoculation.
Schuyler," Eliza said. "As in General Philip Schuyler?" The name did the trick for the heavier fellow.
"Of course, Miss Schuyler. I'm Corporal Weston. Please give me a moment to collect the men. Where would you ladies like to perform the procedure?"
"Over there by the fireplace," Eliza said with immediate confidence. "The room is sufficiently warm that the men won't be chilled when they remove their jackets, and there are extra chairs, which I shall need." Peggy held the supplies basket, while Angelica looked around with an unimpressed air. "May I?" Angelica sat herself down on the nearest chair. Peggy followed suit and moved to unload the supplies in the basket. "Stop, sister! Germs! Germs!" Eliza blanched. "First, clear the table for our equipment. Nothing must touch the floor." Angelica was taken aback by her middle sister's bold new confidence in this strange arena. Clearly, in the brief time she had been away from Albany, she had taken on some impressive new strength. But then Eliza had always been the quickest study of the three of them. Angelica turned to Peggy, who was staring open-mouthed at Eliza. "Well, what are you waiting for, Peggy? You heard sister. Put the basket on a chair and help me clear this table for her. She's got important work to do." Corporal Weston glanced nervously at the basket and gave it a wide berth as he headed for the door. Eliza thought him a bit dim. His companion looked equally skittish and made to follow his friend, but Eliza stopped him. "Larpent, isn't it?" Eliza spoke briskly. "The building is not so large that it will take two of you to gather everyone, Mr. Larpent, so why don't we start with you? Peggy,
Fetch me a pitcher of water from the kitchen.
Larpent glanced desperately at Weston, but his friend was making a grand show out of leading Peggy to the kitchen, despite the fact that she had just walked through it.
"Of course, Miss Schuyler," Larpent said in a resigned voice. "What should I do?"
"You need do nothing but remove your jacket, roll up your left sleeve, and have a seat here."
Larpent took off his jacket, unbuttoned the lace flounce from his cuff, and began to roll up the sleeve.
"Is there any reason why it's the left arm?"
"The procedure will cause a slight rash that can make writing a bit uncomfortable."
"I suppose I am left-handed. Oh, well, it's a pity. Perhaps I'll come back another day."
Larpent jumped up in relief.
Eliza grabbed his sleeve. "Please relax, Mr. Larpent. The treatment is just as effective on the right arm as the left."
Larpent sat down.
"It doesn't matter," he said dejectedly. "I'm not actually left-handed."
"Mr. Larpent," Eliza said with a laugh, "are you nervous about the procedure? I assure you, there's nothing to worry about. I have had it myself, along with my entire family, including my 7-year-old brother and both of my sisters."
"A remarkably courageous act for such a young boy," said Angelica. "Of course, he was holding on to Mama's petticoats at the time."
She delivered Larpent a tight smile packed full of derision. Peggy returned from the kitchen, sloshing water from a full pitcher. Eliza began to prepare the paste, measuring conservatively. Though there were only a dozen or so treatments to administer and more than enough medicine, she didn't want to waste any of it. She could feel the young soldier's nervous eyes on her as she mixed the powder and water. At length, he cleared his throat.
I've heard that the treatment doesn't work for everyone."
"If it doesn't work, we'll administer it again."
"But how do you know if it doesn't work?"
"As I said before, if it takes, there will be a rash, as if you had been exposed to itch ivy."
"Will it itch like itch ivy? I had that once when I was a boy, and my mother had to sew socks on my hands to keep me from scratching myself to bloody pieces."
"I assure you, Mr. Larpent, the pox itches far, far worse."
"It's Lieutenant Larpent, actually."
"Of course," Eliza said. "I apologize. So young to be an officer."
Larpent shrugged. "It doesn't mean much in a new army. They hand out ranks like apples in October around here. There are even colonels my age. Colonel Hamilton, for one. But he earned it the hard way, didn't he? Fighting at Brandywine Creek 1 year, and the next alongside Washington himself at the Battle of Monmouth."
Thrilled to hear Colonel Hamilton's name come up so naturally in the conversation, Eliza wished he would say more. But Larpent had moved on from the subject and was complaining about the lack of rations.
"Buck up, Lieutenant Larpent," said Eliza. "Surely the blockade will be over soon. I'm just happy to be able to do my small part for the cause. Now, if you will extend your arm, please."
Larpent gave her his left arm as though she were going to chop off the hand. Eliza grasped it firmly by the forearm and reached for the rake.
"This may sting a bit," she said. And before he could react, she dragged the rake across his wrist.
Larpent groaned.
"Lieutenant," Eliza chided. "It is just a scratch."
"It's not the cut that bothers me," Larpent said. "It's just, I've heard some people get sick from the treatment."
"There will be a rash, as I said, and a light fever."
"I've heard some people die."
Larpent cut her off.
"Lieutenant, would it put your mind at ease to know I have just this week given an inoculation to your Colonel Hamilton? And not for a moment did he doubt its worth or question its after effects. He merely said that if the inoculation was good enough for his general and good enough for his general's men, then it was certainly good enough for him. General Washington would be proud of the example of this brave man. Do you not agree, sir, that we are all fighting the same battle?"
Larpent dropped his chin to his chest.
"If you say so, miss.
but Colonel Hamilton is awful brave. If there was ever anyone among the officers I admire more than the colonel, it could only be the general.
Brave, is he? Said Angelica, exchanging a look with Peggy. Pray, tell us more about this brave young colonel.
I heard all about it from the boys, ma'am. Yes, indeed. It was at Monmouth, the day Colonel Hamilton had his horse shot out from under him. With redcoats swarming over the hill, he was charged head-on by a pistol-wielding cavalryman. So what did he do? He stood his ground. He cut the man down with his sword, swung himself into the empty saddle, and galloped away. At least, that's the way it was handed down to me.
Angelica rolled her eyes. Ah, so the legend begins. But Eliza was thrilled to hear it, even as she noticed Peggy looked a little green around the gills. Please, sister, take a seat before you faint. Lieutenant Larpent, I'm afraid our Peggy is not used to such fantastic stories. Why don't we get on with the less disturbing task of the inoculation treatment, shall we?
Eliza was aware of the mortality statistics surrounding the smallpox inoculation, and knew there was some truth to what the frightened young fellow was saying. For every 100 inoculations, one or two people did in fact develop full-blown smallpox, sometimes fatally. But given that the fatality rate among uninoculated individuals was 30 times higher, she understood that it was a more than acceptable risk. Still, she was too honorable to lie to the worried young man.
Be of good cheer, soldier. You are far, far more likely to die of the pox without this treatment than with it. For that matter, you are more likely to die on the battlefield than from this treatment. Now then, she laid the poultice over the scratches and wrapped it in place. It's in God's hands now.
Larpent blanched.
I'm teasing you, Lieutenant, she said as she knotted the wrapping in place. Everything will be fine. You'll be arm-wrestling again in no time.
16. Officers and Gentlemen. Continental Army Headquarters, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. Just as Eliza finished, Corporal Weston returned to the room with 8 men. Most were younger than 25. Though a couple were older. Eliza scanned the faces eagerly, telling herself she wasn't looking for one face in particular. The officers were surprisingly much more nervous than the enlisted men, and to the degree that Eliza and her sisters could bring themselves to converse with any of them, they gathered that it was because the men had been told just enough about the procedure to fear it, and not enough to understand it. A little education, Eliza reckoned, could sometimes be more dangerous than no education at all. But Eliza had no time for idle talk. The men were mostly young, and all of them extended chivalry to the point of flirtation. They were besotted with Peggy and intimidated by Angelica. It was clear that they didn't get to spend much time in the company of females other than dowagers and servants, and all were eager to make them laugh, or secure some promise of a future dinner, or perhaps even a dance at some point. Eliza tried to answer them in kind, but her words were listless. She had to admit it. She was disappointed that Colonel Hamilton wasn't there. She told herself that she wanted the opportunity to chastise him yet again for his gross assumptions of her imputed behavior 2 years ago, and to call him out in front of an audience. But that argument was losing steam. More than anything now, she wanted to know what it was about her in the first place that would make a young man think she was capable of such wanton actions, and whether those assumptions stood for a more complex affection on Alex's part, or if it was only a baser emotion at the heart of it. She felt a flush spread over her cheeks, as for the 100th time that week, an image of Alex waiting for her in her father's hayloft appeared in her mind. Just yesterday, she had agreed to let him take her on a sleigh ride, if only to see his horse, Hector, once more. Although, as much as she wanted to admit it,
She was feeling a welling of affection toward Hector's master lately, as much, if not more, than for Hector himself. Her current patient, a Colonel Martins, tried to escape.
"You look flushed, Miss Schuyler. Please, allow me to fetch you a glass of cold water."
Eliza held onto his arm and kept him in his chair. "I am quite comfortable, Colonel. Please remain seated until I've finished the procedure." She was just administering a final dose to the genially named Lieutenant Colonel Friendly when she heard the door open in the hallway behind her and a jovial male voice exclaimed,
"Where is he, that scoundrel Hamilton? Tell him to come downstairs with his saber drawn. His fate has caught up with him at last."
At the sound of Colonel Hamilton's name, Eliza's heart tumbled over in her chest in delight.
"Nope, not here, sir," said
Corporal Weston, getting out of the loud officer's way. Eliza did her best to hide her disappointment once more. She glanced up at the three men still in the room, who had come up with excuses for not going to work, or whose rank was high enough that no one could order them to stop flirting with the doctor's pretty aides. But none of them seemed particularly bothered when a pair of flamboyant figures appeared in the door. Both were about Eliza's age, or a year or two older, and both wore particularly smart uniforms cut from the finest wool. One's sleeve declared him a lieutenant colonel, while the other was a major general, and it was hard to say which of the men was the more dashing specimen. The general had dark wavy hair, combed forward over pale cheeks, tinted rosy from the cold. His nose was long and thin and aristocratic, but he smiled in real pleasure when he saw Eliza, who was alone in the room, having sent Angelica and Peggy to search the house to make sure there were no more officers hiding in a cupboard or wardrobe.
"Well, I have certainly come to the right place today. I just passed two stunning beauties in the hall, and now find myself face to face with a third. A good day indeed."
The colonel's features were less refined, the complexion ruddier, but his uniform was, if anything, even more turned out than his companion's. The blue jacket as crisp as if it had just been ironed, the boots still in high polish, though the officers must have been riding for some time to get here from wherever they were coming from. A few wisps of brown hair showed in his whiskers, but the rest of his hair was freshly powdered. This was a man who cared about how he looked, how others saw him. When he saw Eliza looking at him, he put a hand to his chest and bowed low.
"I beg your pardon, miss,"
he said in a comically loud southern accent.
"Had I known there were female presences in this house of fallen men, I would have tied up my companion with the horses outside."
"Had you known there were women inside, Lawrence?" the general scoffed. "You probably would have slunk around to the back door to save yourself the embarrassment of being passed over for a man of both higher breeding and higher rank."
Lawrence. Eliza recognized the name instantly, and the southern accent reinforced her thinking. Henry Lawrence from South Carolina was the president of the Continental Congress. This must be one of his sons. The dark-haired officer's accent was also intriguing. It was definitely European, but it had a certain aristocratic universality, which made it hard to tell if it was French or Spanish or Italian. Eliza had just decided it was French when the general said,
"Allow me to introduce myself, mademoiselle. I am Marie-Joseph Paul-Yves Roche-Gilbert de Moutier, Marquis de Lafayette. But you may call me Gil,
or you can just call him Marie, which is what everyone else calls him,"
Colonel Lawrence cut in, extending his hand with American frankness.
"John Lawrence," he said. "A mere three syllables next to my friend's 25, but what I lack in letters I make up for in charm."
Eliza watched this display with increasingly widened eyes. At length she said, "I would shake your hand, but I have smallpox on my fingers."
Colonel Lawrence couldn't have jumped back any faster had a cobra come out of her mouth. In half a second, he was on the other side of the room, the Marquis well on his heels. Eliza burst out laughing. The Marquis was the first to recover.
"I beg your pardon, mademoiselle, but I thought you said smallpox."
"I did say smallpox, General." Angelica and Peggy swooped back into the room, empty-handed. "It appears word has gotten out." Angelica sent a scowl in Corporal Weston's direction. "There's suddenly not a soul left to be found out there." "You see, General," said Eliza with a wave of her hand, "my sisters and I are here on an errand of medicine, inoculating the good soldiers of our army against an enemy more fearsome than all the British and Hessian troops."
"You girls," the southern gentleman seemed surprised. "Inoculating our troops?"
"Every one of them," replied Eliza. "Why, the man you were calling out for, Colonel Hamilton, just received his yesterday. Would you like to follow in his footsteps?" Eliza smiled her first real smile of the day. There was something immediately likable about this fellow Lawrence.
Lawrence scratched at his arm. "The Marquis," he pronounced it in a mocking tone. "And I had that procedure done some years ago. I commend you for your bravery, but I found the whole affair unnatural and unnerving."
"What? You have been inoculated? Then you have nothing to fear." As she spoke, she stood up, motioning to Peggy to begin packing up the supplies. Lawrence retreated farther behind a chair.
"I must take my American friend's side in this matter. If God had not wanted us to catch smallpox, he would not have made it in the first place," said Lafayette.
Angelica had finished packing and made to leave the room, but could no longer hold her tongue. "That is the most absurd statement I have ever heard. The Lord presents us with trials so that we may use our God-given gifts to overcome them, not to give in to them. By your logic, we would all be naked and living in caves, a condition that I am sure Colonel Lawrence would find not at all appealing."
"Touché, mademoiselle. You are quite correct."
The Marquis snickered more at her than with her. He gave her a frank, appraising look that started at the top of her head and landed at her toes. Angelica smiled to herself as she scooped up the last of the supplies and laid them in the basket. "Peggy, it is high time we left here. Eliza can join us back at Aunt Gertrude's after she finishes her duties with these gentlemen." Eliza didn't understand why Angelica was rushing Peggy off. Neither did Peggy, apparently, judging by the confused expression on her face. Then her older sister caught Eliza's eye with a wink and a nod in the direction of the charming Colonel Lawrence, and Eliza realized Angelica was playing matchmaker.
"Forgive my friend's lack of faith in your brave efforts,"
the Marquis called to Angelica and Peggy as they headed out of the room.
"Our Lawrence is full of hubris. Indeed, I have discovered vanity to be endemic among southern men." "Said the man who goes on campaign with 3 servants, 2 jewelry boxes, and wears knickers lined with mink,"
Lawrence teased. Angelica smirked. "Good day, gentlemen," she said, as she pivoted on her shoe and left the room, Peggy right behind her. The Marquise's legs squeezed tightly together.
"Mon Dieu, I see your northern winters are as blessed cold as your women." "They are not my northern winters," Lawrence said, laughing. "I would give anything to be home in Carolina right now. But at least there is something here to relieve the cold. And since the Marquis has, despite his many names and titles, failed to ask, may I inquire as to your name, mademoiselle?"
"Unlike you, Colonel Lawrence, I value my name highly, and don't just hand it out to any lieutenant colonel or major general who asks, even if one of them is a Marquis. So, what will you give me if I tell you my name?" Lawrence smiled.
I would offer you my heart, miss, but I fear it is not worth a tenth of what you offer in exchange.
Indeed, Colonel, Eliza said, especially since you seem to deal it out like playing cards.
I, on the other hand, the Marquis said, reaching a hand into his greatcoat and pulling out a bottle of amber liquid, have a bottle of 10-year-old cognac shipped from my estate on the far side of the Atlantic. Perhaps you would do me the honor of sharing it with me, Miss...
Eliza put down her basket of supplies and extended her hand to the Marquis. Schuyler, Elizabeth Schuyler, but you may call me Eliza. Thank you kindly, but I have quite a bit more work this evening and will have to decline your good hospitality.
Eliza Schuyler?
Said Colonel Lawrence with a piercing gaze. Yes, the one and the same, she said, and wondered at the look he gave her. 17. Guess who's coming to dinner? The Cochrane residence, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. Eliza awoke the next morning to someone knocking insistently at her bedroom door. Yes, she called.
Eliza, darling, it's Aunt Gertrude. Your Uncle John and I were asleep last night when you three returned home. I just want to make sure all is well. May I come in? I have coffee.
Of course, Auntie. I'm so sorry to have overslept. It was a long day. Aunt Gertrude entered, bearing a small tray with a covered pot and cup and saucer. There was concern on her face, as well as amusement, as she set the tray on the bedside table.
Exhausted, no doubt. I'm afraid your mother would be quite displeased with me, working you girls so hard.
Eliza smiled back ruefully.
By the by, Colonel Hamilton was nice enough this morning to bring over the inoculation supplies you left in General Washington's office. I think he hoped to return them personally.
Eliza felt a blush spread itself on her cheeks as she reached for the coffee cup on the bedside table and sipped at it.
Well, her aunt said, I hope yesterday didn't take too much out of you, because there are festivities tonight.
Really? Is one of the officers' wives throwing a party? Or the Baron?
No, we are, Aunt Gertrude said mischievously.
You? Mama always said you had the festive sensibility of a...
Eliza didn't finish the sentence. I meant, she said that you and Dr. Cochrane were both too busy with your important work to entertain much.
What Mrs. Schuyler had actually said was that her sister-in-law was about as much fun as a Puritan on All Hallows' Eve, dressed in black wool, clinging to a cross and seeing devils and witches in every shadow. But Eliza thought it better to rephrase her mother's barb.
Well, it's not a party, per se, just a dinner gathering. Stephen Van Rensselaer is in town. I wager he couldn't keep away from Peggy and followed her here, so we're holding a small dinner for him. And when we heard that such prestigious figures as Colonel Lawrence and General Lafayette were here as well, of course we had to invite them along, with Colonel Hamilton.
Hearing that Colonel Hamilton would be at the party quickened Eliza's pulse. Try as she might to pretend it wasn't so, that rascal had gotten under her skin somehow. Suddenly, the confident girl with the practical clothes was wondering what sort of fancy dress she might find for the dinner. Maybe borrow something from Peggy. And that was surprising about Stephen Van Rensselaer. She had to give him credit for following Peggy to Morristown. He certainly couldn't be faulted for lack of interest. She turned her attention back to her aunt.
The Marquis has already agreed to bring a barrel of wine with him. He seems, despite the British blockade, to have an endless supply. The French are of different priorities, I suppose, said Aunt Gertrude, adjusting her cameo brooch. Well, perhaps you should rest this afternoon, dear, so that you have energy for the dinner.
A twinkle appeared in her aunt's eye.
Colonel Hamilton accepted our invitation most eagerly and said that he was
especially excited to have the chance to continue his acquaintance with you.
Did he? Eliza exclaimed before she could stop herself.
He did, indeed.
Her aunt smiled at her slyly.
Shall I have the maid bring up some toast in a bit?
Yes, thank you, Eliza said. She barely heard her aunt as the older woman slipped out of the room. 6 hours later found Eliza ready for the party, dressed in a violet gown lightly embroidered with gold threads and pearls. Her aunt had sent Louisa, the servant girl, up with it, and Eliza decided not to pursue the same old argument about how it was unbecoming for a woman of her stature to dress in finery while the soldiers went about in rags. They were in the headquarters of the Continental Army, for one thing, where the soldiers were as well appointed as it was possible for soldiers to be. And the truth is, she wanted to look especially nice on this occasion. Angelica's and Peggy's arrival had made her acutely aware that she was the only one of the grown Schuyler sisters without a beau. And after all, she had not picked the dress out herself. Her mother had packed it for her. To let it wrinkle in a trunk would be wasteful. Not practical at all. She even consented to wear a wig. Once it was on, she wondered that she did not wear one more often. It kept drafts off the head, for one thing, and for another, one did not have to sit still for half an hour or an hour while a maid teased and styled and powdered and sprayed every strand of hair in place. One need only pin one's own hair up and sit as the great silver confection was lowered onto the head, and voila! An ordinary girl was transformed into a ravishing mademoiselle. When she came down the stairs, nearly 20 people were sitting down to dinner already. Tables had been lined up in the hall downstairs and covered with several sheets of embroidered ivory linen. The plates were embossed with a gold and green Chinese pattern and edged with a gold rim, the silver heavy and ornate. The stemware was pewter, but polished to such a high sheen that it shone like silver in the light of the 3 8-stemmed candelabras gracing the table.
The kitcheners did set a fine table, Aunt Gertrude noted as Eliza appeared downstairs. But you'll be its jewel tonight. Come, she added. Your sisters have already taken their places in the front parlor.
Peggy and Angelica were chatting among a half-dozen other early guests, including Stephen Van Rensselaer. In the 2 years since that first dance with Peggy, he had grown by nearly 8 inches, and now stood a full head taller than Eliza's sister. She was glad to see he had turned out to be a fine-looking, if rather serious, young man.
Rensselaer, Wick, my father's manor, amounts to some 768,000 square acres, or 1,200 square miles, which is roughly the same size as Long Island. We rent to more than 3,000 tenant farmers and their families, who together manage thousands of cattle, sheep, pigs, yes, and turkeys, ducks, rabbits, and—
Angelica came up and whispered into Eliza's ear. And titmice, and 17-year locusts, and 72 different varieties of flea. The sisters laughed softly. Angelica added, Mrs. Witherspoon made the mistake of asking him what he wanted to be when he grew up. He said he would be a patroon of the manor, and has been detailing exactly what his holdings will be for nearly 15 minutes. I can't tell if people are too afraid of his wealth to interrupt, or if they've simply been stunned into silence.
Wheat is the primary grain crop, but also oats and rye and corn and alfalfa and milo and—
droned young Stephen. Eliza laughed into her gloved hand. Perhaps the young man still had a few social graces to master.
We shouldn't be so hard on him, Ange. He is so young, after all, and his responsibilities will be vast indeed.
She glanced at Peggy, who was managing to regard her pontificating suitor with an expression that attempted to pass for genuine interest. Do you think that Peggy will really marry him? I would hate to see her trapped with a bore for the rest of her life just because he was rich.
Rich? Angelica said.
He's so far beyond rich, there isn't a word for him. There are some who say that his father is the wealthiest man in all the colonies, wealthier even than John Hancock or Benjamin Franklin, which means he will be too. Eliza nodded but corrected her sister. You mean the United States. Oh, can we not talk about the war tonight? Angelica moaned. It's all Papa ever talks about, and my Mr. Church, too. Can we not be happy mademoiselles for once, and talk about dresses and dinner courses and Samuel Richardson's novels and secret rendezvous? Stephen's voice carried on.
Made it a personal goal to travel each and every foot of the 4,649 miles of roads and paths that crisscross the manor. By my calculation, I have traveled approximately 949.5 miles, which means I have 3,000...
Who says 949.5 is an approximate number? Angelica moaned. She was about to go on when Eliza stopped her. Did you mention Mr. Church? Are you still seeing him? Angelica coyly looked away. Not exactly. What do you mean, not exactly? Have you broken things off? Not exactly. Angelica said again, clearly enjoying being mysterious. Angelica Schuyler, don't make me pinch you in a parlor full of people. Angelica turned to Eliza and grabbed her hand. Church is on his way here. What? Eliza spoke so heartily that everyone in the room, except Stephen, looked over at her.
Sometimes I use a whip when I travel, other times I ride horseback, and still other times I go on foot.
Stephen continued, oblivious.
When on foot, I find it expedient to employ a walking stick. After much trial and error, I have found that an ash limb has the appropriate combination of strength, lightness, and springiness for— Oh, hello, Miss Schuyler,
he interrupted himself, nodding at Eliza, but mercifully not crossing to her and trapping her within his conversational prison.
I did not see you come in. I was telling Mrs. Witherspoon how I prefer to employ an ash limb as a walking stick when I—
Eliza nodded and turned back to Angelica. When? I am meeting him tonight. I think he means to propose. And you will accept him? Angelica only smiled. But how will you get Papa to consent? He thinks Mr. Church to be a scoundrel and a knave. Scoundrel and knave are redundant, but thank you for the vote of confidence, Angelica said drolly. And Mama has made it clear she believes the continuing source of his wealth to be suspicious, if not altogether ill-gotten. That hurdle, at least, has been cleared. John's business is stable and doing rather well, said Angelica.
The revenue for the farms amounts to some 10,000 shillings, which comes to approximately 100,000 continentals,
droned Stephen. And what is John's business? Eliza asked. He has always been rather mysterious about his affairs. It is rather exciting, Angelica said. He runs guns. Runs them? Like an infantryman? No, it is a euphemism for arms dealing. He procures weapons from French and German munitions manufacturers and sells them to— The Redcoats? But that's horrible. He is helping our enemy. Eliza, do you think I could align myself with a redcoat or a sympathizer? He sells weapons to the Continental Army. That's why he has to be so quiet about it. He is still a British citizen, after all. If he were to get caught, he would be stripped of his citizenship at the very least, and more likely executed as a traitor, said Angelica, quite indignant. Oh, Eliza exclaimed. That is romantic and patriotic. Well, not patriotic for him, I suppose, if he remains British. Why doesn't he become an American? Angelica shrugged. He says he admires America greatly, but that he cannot help being British to the core. He would like to introduce our reforms to England, to reduce the power of the crown and see Parliament become more democratic. He says the old world can learn much from the new and must learn, or it will be left behind.
Eliza absorbed all this with some surprise. So that was why John Church was always so vague in conversation. But now she understood. He was protecting himself and his interests. It explained Angelica's interest in him, too. She had assumed that her headstrong older sister was attracted to John simply because he was everything their parents despised, which was fine for an adolescent crush, but didn't explain the endurance of the attraction over several years. But now she realized that her sister had fallen in love with a man of principle. She wished he was a handsomer fellow, to match Angelica's beauty. But looks fade, after all, and intelligence and character are what sustain a relationship. "Oh, Angelica, this is so exciting. Church is on his way. How romantic. If Mama approves, I'm sure she'll be able to wear Papa down." Angelica shrugged, as if the blessing of their parents were of little concern to her. "Papa will do what he wants to do, and so will I." "You wicked girl," Eliza said, scandalized and titillated at the same time. At that moment, a heavy round of footsteps landed on the front porch. Ulysses opened the front door to a jocular crowd of men streaming in, pulling off their coats and hats and dumping them into the servant girl's thin brown arms.
"Girls, our guests,"
Aunt Gertrude said to the Schuyler sisters.
"The officers have arrived."
18. Goose is cooked. Cochrane Dinner Table, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. Dr. Cochrane sharpened the carving knife and fork high in the air over a crispy brown duck, while the rest of the table looked on.
"My word, Dr. Bonds,"
the Marquis said in a teasing voice.
"From the way you are sharpening that knife, one would think you are preparing to operate on General Washington himself. By all means, proceed."
Alex sat back, downright jolly. It had been a long week, and at last, after haunting her window and missing opportunities to see her at headquarters, where she had been near but so far, he was finally in the same place as Eliza Schuyler. His generous hostess had even seen to it that he was seated next to her lovely niece. Alex hoped dinner would go on until the wee hours, as was custom lately. There was nowhere else he would rather be than at the Cochrane dinner table. He smiled as the servants set a variety of savory dishes before the guests. There were three large courses with duck and venison roasts to be carved, with jellies, dried fruits, and nuts served alongside. An endless pile of fresh oysters from the Hudson River was set in front of each officer. Laughter ricocheted from every table as Louisa raced around the room, filling and refilling the wine glasses. Across from him, Lawrence and Lafayette spoke animatedly in bawdy, good-humored French. Alex looked fondly at his fellow aides-de-camp. It was good to see them so relaxed. He turned to his right, stealing a glimpse of Eliza, ravishing in the candlelight. He watched as she leaned in to catch wisps of what French she could figure out. Fluent in the language from his childhood in the West Indies, Alex was charmed by her struggle to understand the officer's racier phrases as she strove to translate them. "A good student," he smiled, as he absent-mindedly scratched the last of the rash on his wrist left over from the inoculation she'd given him. "What is so amusing?" Eliza asked, turning to him. "Are they being very naughty?"
Alex shook his head. "No, I am just enjoying the view," he said. "It is not every day that we are graced with such pleasing company." She blushed, and he liked seeing the rosy flush on her cheeks. It gave him a wellspring of hope. "You look very beautiful tonight, Miss Schuyler," he said bravely. "I hope you will allow me to compliment you."
Eliza lowered her lashes. "I'm afraid I did not pack many party dresses, but thankfully my sisters did."
"I do not think it is the dress," he murmured, finding her dark, almost black eyes,
and the gentleness in them, her most appealing feature. Halfway through the second course, Alex pinged his fork against his wine glass to signify he was making an announcement, and stood up. Conversation ceased, and the entire party gave him their attention.
"Ladies and gentlemen, if I may intrude on your serious conversations for a moment, I'd like to propose a toast of thanks to our host and hostess tonight for giving us the pleasure of eating and drinking at someone else's expense. It puts to shame the many nights we poor soldiers have shared a pint or two of ale at Jacob Arnold's tavern and pretended it was a meal."
"Hear, hear!" came the agreeable shouts from the other officers.
"And what more can be said of the lovely company you have chosen to surround us with tonight, Mrs. Cochrane? The work these ladies are doing is quite sure to save battalions of lives. I salute you for your attention to our country's most basic of needs."
Alex raised his glass toward Eliza, whose dark eyes sparkled with good cheer in recognition of his kind words. He sat back down and leaned over to whisper into her ear.
"Your aunt was overly generous to include me in tonight's dinner party," he confided. "I owed her a few words of praise."
"I think it's fair to say Aunt Gertrude is already quite taken with you, sir, and her seating you next to me at the table is more than just a coincidence. Indeed, she's made it a point to repeat how contentedly she sleeps through these long cold nights lately, knowing that you are out there guarding the house."
Alex bit his lip, trying to suppress a smile at the thought of Aunt Gertrude blissfully snoring away in her night bonnet.
As if she had read his mind, Eliza smiled as well.
"It is nice to see you smiling at me. I take it my presence is not as objectionable to you as in the past," he said.
"I wouldn't go that far," said Eliza, still smiling.
"The weather has been atrocious, and I am sorry for it."
Eliza took a delicate bite from her fork. "Why? Does Mother Nature usually attend to your wishes?"
"Not in the least, but there was to be a dancing assembly on the morrow, but it has been cancelled due to the snowstorm. I wished to take you in the sleigh, only for Hector's sake, of course."
"Of course," said Eliza, turning pink once more. As the meal was winding down, Eliza noticed that Stephen and Peggy had pulled their chairs closer together in a sort of silent pact. She thought perhaps the plethora of words from the shy young man's earlier monologue had squeezed all the air out of him. Angelica started in on him innocently enough. "And what brings you to Morristown in the bleak midwinter, Stephen? Surely it must be a business matter of the utmost importance." She gave Eliza a little wink.
Stephen put down his fork and looked Angelica in the eye. "I came to see Miss Peggy."
"And?"
Angelica pursed her lips and tilted her head in a way that begged for more information. "That is all." Stephen picked up his fork again and continued with his dinner.
Angelica dabbed her lips with her napkin. "My goodness, Stephen, you are quite the conversation stopper. Isn't he, though, Peg?" Peggy glared at her sister as a cool hush descended over the dinner guests. Aunt Gertrude stepped in to break up the awkward moment.
"Perhaps now would be a good time for something sweet?"
She held the tiny silver bell in the air to ring for Louisa.
"And who will be wanting coffee as well?"
Once the dinner plates had been removed, Peggy turned to her aunt with a simple request. "Aunt Gertrude, supper was perfectly splendid, and we know your cook is famous for her lovely desserts. But will you forgive me?"
Peggy rose from her seat, squaring her eyes at Angelica.
I feel a bit of a chill in the air."
Stephen stood up clumsily and pulled back her chair.
"Thank you, Stephen. Shall we take our coffee in the parlor by the fireplace, then?"
"Of course, Miss Peggy. As you wish."
Stephen turned to Aunt Gertrude and bowed low. Eliza noticed the crown of his head where his hair was starting to thin, and something inside her softened toward him.
Sometimes Angelica pushed too hard.
"Mrs. Cochrane," he said stiffly, "I am most obliged for the respectable food tonight."
He pushed the two empty chairs back against the table and followed Peggy out of the room. Perplexed, Aunt Gertrude looked around at Eliza and Angelica.
"He's not much of one for light conversation, is he?"
Eliza, ever the hopeful pragmatist, said.
"Perhaps Peggy sees something in him that we do not."
"Indeed," said Angelica dryly. "He comes from one of the wealthiest families in the state of New York."
At Angelica's smart jibe, Alex felt his ears burning. Could he himself be justly accused of similar selfish calculations in regards to his feelings for Eliza, the second Schuyler daughter?
"Nevertheless, Angelica dear," Aunt Gertrude wisely intervened, "is that reason enough to tie oneself down to a lifetime of masculine silence?"
Alex watched Angelica flinch. He thought her reply seemed touched with an unflattering tinge of bitterness.
"Well," said Angelica, "I for one think they are perfectly suited to each other. He's as passive as a sheep, and Peg is a pretty shepherdess."
Nervous laughter streamed around the table at Peggy and Stephen's expense, before the topic quickly moved on to some of Morristown's more scandalous gossip. Alex noticed Eliza had remained silent and did not seem eager to go along with the unkind joke.
"Aha," thought Alex.
Here beats a softer heart than Angelica's unsentimental one. The room was suddenly too hot for his taste, and he excused himself from the table, saying he needed a bit of fresh air. He went out and took a few deep breaths. His cheeks hurt from smiling at Eliza Schuyler all night. But he was worried, too, that she was too far above him in station for him to even think about courting her. Lost in his own thoughts, he didn't notice Stephen Van Rensselaer stride past, red in the face, and disappear around the corner. Peggy followed him, looking upset. She stopped when she saw Alex.
"Oh, Colonel Hamilton."
"Everything all right, Miss Schuyler?"
She nodded, then changed her mind and shook her head.
"No, Stephen doesn't like Angelica's teasing," she confided. "My sister can be a little too sharp-tongued than is good for her."
"She is only being protective," he said soothingly. "Older sisters tend to be."
Peggy drew herself up to her full height.
"Perhaps," she said. "But you will see one day, when the lash falls on you."
He raised his eyebrows, not quite knowing what to say.
"I spoke out of turn. I apologize," said Peggy.
"There is no need," he assured her.
After a short silence, he said,
"You know, maybe if you told your sisters how you felt about the young man, they would be a little more gentle with him and your feelings."
Peggy appraised him, as if taking his stock for the first time.
"Thank you, Colonel. I might just take your advice."
When Alex returned to the table, Eliza's aunt was standing at the head of it.
"Ah, lovely," she announced. "Dessert is ready."
Lorenz walked around the table and clamped a hand on Alex's shoulder.
"So, Ham, what do you think of my plan to free Southern slaves who are willing to join the fight for independence? Let's take these men out of the fields and let them live like human beings. Free them and train them to fire a musket. Pay them to maintain their loyalty like any enlisted man. Think how it would swell our ranks against the British overnight."
Growing up in the West Indies had given Alex a hatred for slavery and the vile practices he had witnessed firsthand. He admired his wealthy Southern friend for feeling the same way when Lawrence came from a long line of slaveholders himself and had much to benefit from the practice.
"I support it duly, John. Not as your closest friend, but as someone who has seen the depravity of slavery during my childhood. No man could ever find satisfaction in being owned by another,
We are all the same in God's eyes, are we not? And General Washington agrees with me. If only I could persuade him to act on it.
Yes, there's the rub. Too much talk when immediate action is needed. Tell me true, Alex. Is the plan anything more than futile?
Alex turned his palms up to the ceiling. Ah, friend, I am doing all that I can, and yet... Eliza cut in on the conversation.
Though you will continue to press the idea upon him, yes, Colonel? It is the right thing to do. Surely His Excellency understands that.
Alex and Eliza shared a moment of mutual surprise. You support the abolitionist cause? He asked.
Fervently, she said. We Schuylers have always, always espoused a belief in the equality of black and white souls.
It moved him to hear the same perspective coming from this young maiden. Here was something concrete that spoke volumes to the natures of their respective souls. I am glad to hear it, he told her. Without thinking, he reached over the table and grasped her hand, giving it a meaningful squeeze.
Lawrence coughed and turned away with a smile.
And for a moment, Alex enjoyed the feeling of Eliza's small hand in his. Though Mrs. Cochrane was seated too far away to have heard their conversation, it was clear that she noticed something had changed between the soldier and her niece. In a moment, she all but confirmed his supposition with one arched eyebrow.
Cook has discovered a recipe that should put a smile on everyone's face. Tonight, we're having a little tart.
19. Girl Talk. Eliza's Bedroom, Morristown, New Jersey, February 1780. The dinner over and the guests gone home. The Schuyler sisters retired for the evening. Eliza readied for bed, thinking dreamily of the passionate way Colonel Hamilton had spoken to her at the table that evening. His brilliance, his enlightened mind, and his mischievous good humor were hard to dismiss, and, in fact, she kept dwelling on the small, precious moments they had found together all evening. The way his eyes shone when hers caught his across the room upon his arrival. The feel of his hand on her back when he led her out of the room to the ladies' parlor, before retiring to her uncle's study for whiskey and cigars. The way he had sought her out afterward, to say a particularly sweet goodbye. She closed her book and plumped up her pillow, knowing she wouldn't be able to sleep for a while. She was too excited, thinking of him. But she licked her fingers and snuffed out the candle like a good girl nonetheless, just as a knock came at the door.
"Can I come in for a moment?"
It was Peggy, shivering in her cotton nightgown and bare feet. Eliza pulled back the covers and patted the bedding beside her.
"Of course."
Peggy hopped up on the bed and snuggled in beside her older sister. The both of them let out a contented sigh, reveling in the warmth of each other's bodies. Peggy spoke first.
"Remember when we were children, and how we shared a bed and all our secrets, too?"
"Yes, Peg. Happy memories, those."
Eliza closed her eyes, thinking back to the lively Schuyler home with each of the sisters playing a musical instrument. The brothers would chase them all through the fields with their dogs. As often as not, Eliza would lead the way in the foot races.
"Well, I have another secret for you, sister."
Peggy sat up in bed and turned toward Eliza. In the darkness, Eliza could barely see Peggy's perfect nose.
"I have found the only man I shall ever love, and I intend to marry him.
But, dear Peg, you are younger than I. How can you know such a thing at such a tender age?"
"Because of his kindness. He is the only suitor I've ever had who doesn't pretend to know all there is about me, or tells me how beautiful I am, then proceeds to step all over my toes in the most careless ballroom manner.
In fact, I can see it in his eyes that he is most comfortable when I am at his side. Of course, Stephen says relatively little, but... Stephen? We're talking about Stephen,
Eliza said, trying not to sound too shocked for her sister's sake.